4. The classical nations, in accordance with the static Euclidean soul of their culture, were corporeal units of the smallest imaginable size. It was not Hellenes or Ionians that were nations, but in each city the demos, a union of adult men, legally and by the same token nationally defined, between the type of the hero as upper limit and the slave as lower. Footnote. The slave did not belong to the nation. On this account, the enrollment of non-citizens in the army of a city, which on occasions of dire crisis was inevitable, was always felt as a profound blow to the national idea. End of footnote. Syneciscism, that mysterious process of early periods in which the inhabitants of a countryside give up their villages and assemble themselves as a town, marks the moment at which, having arrived at self-consciousness, the classical nation constitutes itself as such. We can still trace the way in which this form of the nation steadily makes good from Homeric times. Even in the Iliad, we can perceive the tendency to the nation-feeling in the small, and even the smallest, aggregates, to the epoch of the great colonizations. It responds exactly to the classical prime symbol. Each folk was a body, visible and surveyable, a soma, the express negation of the idea of geographical space. It is of no importance to classical history whether or not the Etruscans in Italy were identical physically or linguistically with the bearers of this name amongst the sea peoples, or what the relation was between the pre-Homeric units of the Pelasgi or Danai and the later bearers of the Doric or the Hellenic name. If, about 1100, there are Doric and Etruscan primitive peoples, as is probable, nevertheless, a Doric or an Etruscan nation never existed. In Tuscany, as in the Peloponnese, there were only city-states, national points which, in the period of colonization, could only multiply, never expand. The Etruscan wars of Rome were always waged against one or more cities, and the nations that the Persians and the Carthaginians confronted were of this same type. To speak of the Greeks and the Romans, as the 18th century did, and as we still do, is completely erroneous. A Greek nation, in our sense, is a misconception. The Greeks themselves never knew such an idea at all. The name of Hellenes, which arose about 500, did not denote a people, but the aggregate of classical culturemen, the sum of their nations, in contradistinction to the barbarian world. Footnote. It is not to be overlooked that both Plato and Aristotle, in their political writings, were unable to conceive of the ideal people otherwise than in the polis form. But it was equally natural for the 18th century thinkers to regard the ancients as nations after the fashion of Shaftesbury and Montesquieu. It is we, their successors, who ought not to have stayed on that note. End of footnote. And the Romans, a true urban people, could not conceive of their empire otherwise than in the form of innumerable nation points, the civitates, into which, juridically, as in other respects, they dissolved all the primitive peoples of their imperium. When national feeling in this shape is extinguished, there is an end to classical history. It will be the task, one of the heaviest tasks of historians, to trace generation by generation the quiet fading out of the classical nations in the Eastern Mediterranean during the late classical age, and the ever-stronger inflow of a new nation spirit, the Magian. A nation of the Magian type is the community of co-believers, the group of all who know the right way to salvation and are inwardly linked to one another by the ijma of this belief. Men belonged to a classical nation by virtue of the possession of citizenship, but to a Magian nation by virtue of a sacramental act, circumcision for the Jews, specific forms of baptism for the Mandaeans or the Christians. An unbeliever was for a Magian folk what an alien was for a classical. No intercourse with him, no connubium, And this national separation went so far that in Palestine, a Jewish Aramaic and a Christian Aramaic dialect formed themselves side by side. The Faustian nation, though necessarily bound up with a particular religiousness, is not so with a particular confession. The classical nation is by type non-exclusive in its relations to different cults. But the Magian nation comprises neither more nor less than is covered by the idea of one or another of the Magian churches. Inwardly, the classical nation is linked with the city, and the Western with the landscape. But the Arabian knows neither fatherland nor mother tongue. Outwardly, its specific world outlook is only expressed by the distinctive script which each such nation develops as soon as it is born. But for that very reason, the inwardness and hidden force, the magic, in fact, of a Magian nation feeling impresses us Faustians, who notice the absence of the home idea as something entirely enigmatic and uncanny. This tacit, self-secure cohesion, that of the Jews, for example, in the homes of the Western peoples, is what entered Roman law, called by a classical label but worked out by Arameans about the end of the 2nd century of our era as the concept of the juridical person, which is nothing but the Magian notion of a community. Post-exilic Judaism was a juridical person long before anyone had discovered the concept itself. The primitives who preceded this evolution were predominantly tribal associations. Among them, the South Arabian Meneans, who appear about the beginning of the 1st millennium and whose name vanishes in the 1st century before Christ, the Aramaic-speaking Chaldeans, who likewise about 1000 BC sprang up as clan groups and from 659 to 539 ruled the Babylonian world, the Israelites before the exile, a loose group of Edomite tribes which with the Moabites, Amalekites, Ishmaelites and others thus constituted a fairly uniform Hebrew-speaking population, and the Persians of Cyrus. So strongly already the populations felt this form that the priesthoods which developed here, there and everywhere after the time of Alexander received the names of founded or fictitious tribes. Amongst the Jews and the South Arabian Sabaeans, they were called Levites. Amongst the Medes and Persians, Magi, after an extinct Indian tribe. And amongst the adherents of the new Babylonian religion, Chaldeans, also after a disintegrated clan grouping. But here, as in all other cultures, the energy of the national consensus completely overrode the old tribal arrangements of the primitives. Just as the Populus Romanus unquestionably contained folk elements of very varied provenance, and as the nation of the French took in Salian Franks and Romanic and old Celtic natives alike, so the Magian nation also ceased to regard origin as a distinguishing mark. The process, of course, was an exceedingly long one. The tribe still counts for much with the Jews of the Maccabean period, and even with the Arabs of the first caliphs. But for the inwardly ripened culture peoples of this world, such as the Jews of the Talmudic period, it no longer possessed any meaning. He who belongs to the faith belongs to the nation. It would have been blasphemy even to admit any other distinction. In early Christian times, the prince of Adiabene, the district south of Lake Van, of which the capital was Arbela, the old home of the goddess Ishtar, went over to Judaism with his people in a body, and they were all ipso facto incorporated in the Jewish nation. The same applies to the nobility of Armenia and even the Caucasian tribes, which at that period must have Judaized on a large scale, and in the opposite direction to the Bedouins of Arabia, right down to the extreme south, and beyond them again to African tribes as far afield as Lake Chad, as evidenced by the Falasha, the black Jews of Abyssinia. Here evidently is a national common feeling proof even against such race distinctions as these. It is stated that even today Jews can amongst themselves distinguish very different races at the first glance, and that in the ghettos of Eastern Europe the tribes, in the Old Testament sense, are clearly recognized. But none of this constitutes a difference of nation. According to von Erkert, the West European Jew type is universally distributed within the non-Jewish Caucasian peoples, whereas, according to Weissenberg, it does not occur at all amongst the long-headed Jews of southern Arabia, where the Sabaean tomb sculptures show a human type that might almost claim to be Roman or Germanic, and is the ancestor of these Jews who were converted by missionary effort at least by the birth of Christ. But this resolution of the tribal primitives into the Magian nations of Persians, Jews, Mandeans, Christians and the rest must have occurred quite generally and on an immense scale. I have already drawn attention to the decisive fact that long before the beginning of our era, the Persians represented simply a religious community, and it is certain that their numbers were indefinitely increased by accessions to the Mazdaist faith. The Babylonian religion vanished at that time, which means that its adherents became in part Jews and in part Persians. But emerging from it, there is a new religion, inwardly alien to both Jewish and Persian, an astral religion which bears the name of the Chaldees, and whose adherents constituted a genuine Aramaic-speaking nation. From this Aramean population of Chaldean, Jewish, Persian nationality came, firstly, the Babylonian Talmud, the Gnosis, and the religion of Mani, and secondly, in Islamic times, Sufism and the Shia. Moreover, as seen from Edessa, the inhabitants of the classical world, they also appear as nations in the Magian style. The Greeks, in the Eastern idiom, means the aggregate of all who adhered to the syncretic cults, and were bound together by the Ijmar of the late classical religiousness. The Hellenistic city-nations are no longer in the picture, which shows only one community of believers, the worshippers of the mysteries, who under the names of Helios, Jupiter, Mithras, Theosopsistos, worshipped a kind of Yahweh or Allah. Throughout the East, Greekness is a definite religious notion, and for that matter one completely concordant with the facts as they then were. The feeling of the polis is almost extinct, and a Magian nation needs neither home nor community of origin. Even the Hellenism of the Seleucid Empire, which made converts in Turkestan and on the Indus, was related in inward form to Persian and post-exilic Judaism. Later, the Aramean Porphyry, the pupil of Plotinus, attempted to organize this Greekness as a cult church on the model of the Christian and the Persian, and the Emperor Julian raised it to the dignity of being the state church, an act not merely religious, but also, and above all, national. When a Jew sacrificed to Sol or to Apollo, he thereby became a Greek. So, for example, Ammonius Saccas, died 242, the teacher of Plotinus and probably also of Origen, went over from the Christians to the Greeks. So also Porphyry, born Malchus, and like the Roman jurist Ulpian, a Phoenician of Tyre. In these cases we see jurists and state officials taking Latin and philosophers Greek names, and for the philological spirit of modern and religious research, this is quite historical enough to justify these men's being regarded as Roman and Greek in the classical city-national sense. But how many of the great Alexandrines may have been Greeks only in the Magian sense of the term? In point of birth, were not Plotinus and Diophantus perhaps Jews or Chaldeans? Now, the Christians also felt themselves from the outset as a nation of the Magian caste, and moreover the others, Greeks, heathen, and Jews alike, regarded them as such. Quite logically, the latter considered their secession from Judaism as high treason, and the former their missionary infiltration into the classical cities as an invasion and conquest, while the Christians, on their side, designated people of other faiths as Taethne. When the Monophysites and the Nestorians separated themselves from the Orthodox, new nations came into being, as well as new churches. The Nestorians, since 1450, have been governed by the Ma Shumun, who was at once prince and patriarch of his people, and vis-à-vis the Sultan occupied exactly the same position as, long before, the Jewish Reish Galuta had occupied in the Persian Empire. This nation consciousness, derived from particular and defined world feeling, and therefore self-evident with an a priori sureness, cannot be ignored if we are to understand the later persecutions of the Christians. The Magian state is inseparably bound up with the concept of orthodoxy. Caliphate, nation and church form an intimate unit. It was as states that Adiabene went over to Judaism. Osrini, about 200, so soon, from Greekdom to Christendom. Armenia in the 6th century from the Greek to the Monophysite Church. Each of these events expresses the fact that the state was identical with the Orthodox community as a juridical person. If Christians lived in the Islamic state, Nestorians in the Persian, Jews in the Byzantine, they did not and could not, as unbelievers, belong to it, and consequently were thrown back upon their own jurisdictions. If, by reason of their numbers or their missionary spirit, they became a threat to the continuance of the identity of state and creed community, persecution became a national duty. It was on this account that first the Orthodox, or Greek, and then the Nestorian Christians suffered in the Persian Empire. Diocletian also, who as Caliph, Dominus et Deus, had linked the Imperium with the pagan cult churches, and saw himself in all sincerity as commander of these faithful, could not evade the duty of suppressing the second church. Constantine changed the true church, and in that act changed the nationality of the Byzantine Empire. From that point on, the Greek name slowly passed over to the Christian nation, and specifically to that Christian nation which the emperor, as head of the faithful, recognized and allowed to sit in the great councils. Hence the uncertain lines of the picture of Byzantine history. In 290, the organization that of a classical imperium, but the substance already a Magian national state. In 312, a change of nationality without change of name. Under this name of Greeks, first paganism as a nation fought the Christians, and then Christianity as a nation fought Islam. And in the latter fight, Islam itself being a nation also, the Arabian, nationality stamped itself more and more deeply upon events. Hence the present-day Greeks are a creation of the Magian culture, developed first by the Christian Church, then by the sacred language of this church, and finally by the name of this church. Islam brought with it from the home of Muhammad the Arab name as the badge of its nationality. It is a mistake to equate these Arabs with the Bedouin tribes of the desert. What created the new nation, with its passionate and strongly characteristic soul, was the consensus of the new faith. Its unity is no more derived from race and home than that of the Christian, Jewish, or Persian, and therefore it did not migrate. Rather, it owes its immense expansion to the incorporation within itself of the greater part of the early Magian nations. With the end of the first millennium of our era, these nations, one and all, pass over into the form of fellah peoples, and it is as fellahin that the Christian peoples of the Balkans under Turkish rule, the Parsis in India, and the Jews in Western Europe have lived ever since. In the West, nations of Faustian style emerge more and more distinctly from the time of Otto the Great, 936 to 973, and in them the primitive peoples of the Carolingian period are swiftly dissolved. Footnote. I am convinced that the nations of China, which sprang up in members in the middle Huang Ho region at the beginning of the Zhou dynasty, as also the regional peoples of the Egyptian Old Kingdom, which had each its own capital and its own religion, and as late as Roman times fought each other in definitely religious wars, were in their inward form more closely akin to the peoples of the West than to those of the classical and the Arabian worlds. However, research into such fields has hitherto been conspicuous by its absence. End of footnote. Already by AD 1000, the men who mattered most were everywhere beginning to sense themselves as Germans, Italians, Spaniards, Frenchmen, whereas hardly six generations earlier their ancestors had been to the depths of their souls Franks, Lombards, and Visigoths. The people form of this culture is founded, like its Gothic architecture and its infinitesimal calculus, upon a tendency to the infinite in the spatial as well as the temporal sense. The nation feeling comprises, to begin with, a geographical horizon that, considering the period and its means of communication, can only be called vast and is not paralleled in any other culture. The fatherland, as extent, as a region whose boundaries the individual has scarcely, if ever, seen, and which nevertheless he will defend and die for, is something that in its symbolic depth and force men of other cultures can never comprehend. The Magian nation does not as such possess an earthly home. The classical possesses it only as a point focus. The actuality that, even in Gothic times, united men from the banks of the Adige with men in the order castles of Lithuania in an association of feeling would have been inconceivable even in ancient China and ancient Egypt, and stands in the sharpest opposition to the actuality of Rome and Athens, where every member of the demos had the rest constantly in sight. Still stronger is the sensitivity to distance in time. Before the fatherland idea, which is a consequence of the existence of the nation, emerged at all, this passion evolved another idea to which the Faustian nations owe that existence, the dynastic idea. Faustian peoples are historical peoples, communities that feel themselves bound together not by place or consensus, but by history. And the eminent symbol and vessel of the common destiny is the ruling house. For Egyptian and for Chinese mankind, the dynasty is a symbol of quite other meaning. Here what it signifies, as a will and an activity, is time. All that we have been, all that we would be, is manifested in the being of the one generation. And our sense of this is much too profound to be upset by the worthlessness of a regent. What matters is not the person, but the idea. And it is for the sake of the idea that thousands have so often marched to their deaths with conviction in a genealogical quarrel. Classical history was, for classical eyes, only a chain of incidents leading from moment to moment. Magian history was, for its members, the progressive actualization in and through mankind of a world plan laid down by God and accomplished between a creation and a cataclysm. But Faustian history is, in our eyes, a single grand willing of conscious logic, in the accomplishment of which nations are led and represented by their rulers. It is a trait of race. Rational foundations it has not and cannot have. It has simply been felt so, and because it has been felt so, the companion trust of the Germanic migration time developed on into the feudal trust of the Gothic, the loyalty of the Baroque, and the merely seemingly undynastic patriotism of the 19th century. We must not misjudge the depth and dignity of this feeling because there is an endless catalogue of perjured vassals and peoples, and an eternal comedy in the cringing of courtiers and the abjectness of the vulgar. All great symbols are spiritual and can be comprehended only in their highest forms. The private life of a pope bears no relation to the idea of the papacy. Henry the Lion's very defection shows how fully, in a time of nation-forming, a real ruler feels the destiny of his people incorporated in himself. He represents that destiny in the face of history, and at times it costs him his honour to do so. All nations of the West are of dynastic origins. In the Romanesque and even in early Gothic architecture, the soul of the Carolingian primitives still quivers through. There is no French or German Gothic, but Salian, Rhenish, and Swabian, as there is Visigothic, northern Spain, southern France, and Lombard and Saxon Romanesque. But over it all there spreads soon the minority, composed of men of race, that feels membership in a nation as a great historical vocation. From it proceed the Crusades, and in them there truly were French and German chivalries. It is the hallmark of Faustian peoples that they are conscious of the direction of their history. But this direction attaches to the sequence of the generations, and so the nature of the race ideal is genealogical through and through. Darwinism, even, with its theories of descent and inheritance, is a sort of caricature of Gothic heraldry, and the world as history, when every individual lives in the plane of it, contains not only the tree of the individual family, ruling or other, but also the tree of the people as the basic form of all its happenings. It needs very exact observation to perceive that this Faustian genealogical principle, with its eminently historical notions of Ebenbürtigkeit, equivalence by virtue of birth, and of purity of blood, is just as alien to the Egyptians and Chinese, for all their historical disposition, as it is to the Roman nobility and the Byzantine Empire. On the other hand, neither our peasantry nor the patriciate of the cities is conceivable without it. The scientific conception of the people, which I have dissected above, is derived essentially from the genealogical sense of the Gothic period. The notion that the peoples have their trees has made the Italians proud to be the heirs of Rome, and the Germans proud to recall their Teuton forefathers, and that is something quite different from the classical belief in timeless descent from heroes and gods. And eventually, when after 1789 the notion of mother tongue came to be fitted on to the dynastic principle, the once merely scientific fancy of a primitive Indo-Germanic people transformed itself into a deeply felt genealogy of the Aryan race. And in the process, the word race became almost a designation for destiny. But the races of the West are not the creators of the great nations, but their result. Not one of them had yet come into existence in Carolingian times. It was the class ideal of chivalry that worked creatively in different ways upon Germany, England, France, and Spain, and impressed upon an immense area that which within the individual nations is felt and experienced as race. On this rest, as I have said before, the nations, so historical, so alien to the classical, of equivalence by birth, peerage, Ebenbürtigkeit, and blood purity. It was because the blood of the ruling family incorporated the destiny, the being, of the whole nation, that the state system of the Baroque was of genealogical structure, and that most of the grand crises assumed the form of wars of dynastic succession. Even the catastrophic ruin of Napoleon, which settled the world's political organization for a century, took its shape from the fact that an adventurer dared to drive out with his blood that of the old dynasties, and that his attack upon a symbol made it historically a sacred duty to resist him. For all these peoples were the consequence of dynastic destinies. That there is a Portuguese people, and a Portuguese Brazil in the midst of Spanish America, is the result of the marriage of Count Henry of Burgundy in 1095. That there are Swiss and Hollanders is the result of a reaction against the House of Habsburg. That Lorraine is the name of a land and not of a people is a consequence of the childlessness of Lothar II. It was the Kaiser idea that welded the disjunct primitives of Charlemagne's time into the German nation. Germany and empire are inseparable ideas. The fall of the Hohenstaufens meant the replacement of one great dynasty by a handful of small and tiny ones. And the German nation of Gothic style was inwardly shattered even before the beginning of the Baroque. That is, at the very time when the nation idea was being raised to higher levels of intellect in leader cities like Paris, Madrid, London, and Vienna. The Thirty Years' War, so conventional history says, destroyed Germany in its flower. Not so. The fact that it could occur at all in this wretched form simply confirmed and showed up a long-completed decadence. It was the final consequence of the fall of the Hohenstaufens. There could hardly be a more convincing proof that Faustian nations are dynastic units. But then again, the Salians and the Hohenstaufens created also, at least in idea, an Italian nation out of Romans, Lombards and Normans. Only the empire made it possible for them to stretch a hand back to the age of Rome. Even though alien power evoked the hostility of the townsmen and split the two primary orders, the nobles to the emperor, the priests to the pope, even though in these conflicts of Guelph and Ghibelline the nobility soon lost its importance and the papacy rose through the anti-dynastic cities to political supremacy, even though at the last there was but a tangle of predatory states whose Renaissance politics opposed the soaring world policy of the Gothic Empire, as Milan of old had defied the will of Frederick Barbarossa, yet the ideal of Una Italia, the ideal for which Dante sacrificed the peace of his life, was a pure dynastic creation of the great German emperors. The Renaissance, whose historical horizon was that of the urban patriciate, led the nation as far out of the path of self-fulfillment as it is possible to imagine. All through the Baroque and Rococo, the land was depressed to the state of being a mere pawn in the power politics of alien houses. And not until after 1800 did Romanticism arise and reawaken the Gothic feeling with an intensity that made of it a political power. The French people was forged out of Franks and Visigoths by its kings. It learnt to feel itself as a whole for the first time at Bouvines in 1214. Still more significant is the creation of the House of Habsburg, which, out of a population linked neither by speech, nor folk feeling, nor tradition, caused to arise the Austrian nation, which proved its nationhood in defending Maria Theresa and in resisting Napoleon, its first tests and its last. The political history of the Baroque age is, in essentials, the history of the houses of Bourbon and Habsburg. The rise of the House of Wettin in place of that of Welf is the reason why Saxony was on the Weser in 800 and is on the Elbe today. Dynastic events, and finally the intervention of Napoleon, brought it about that half of Bavaria has shared in the history of Austria, and that the Bavarian state consists for the most part of Franconia and Swabia. The latest nation of the West is the Prussian. A creation of the Hohenzollerns, as the Roman was the last creation of the classical polis feeling, and the Arabian the last product of a religious consensus. At Fehbelin, the young nation gained its recognition. At Rossbach, it won for Germany. It was Goethe who, with his infallible eye for historic turning points, described the then new Minne von Barnhelm as the first German poetry of specifically national content. It is one more example, and a deeply significant one, to show how dynastically the Western nations defined themselves, that Germany thus at one stroke rediscovered her poetic language. The collapse of the Hohenstaufen rule had been accompanied by that of Germany's Gothic literature also. What did emerge here and there in the following centuries, the golden age of all the Western literatures, was undeserving of the name. But with the victories of Frederick the Great, a new poesy began. From Lessing to Hebbel means the same as from Rossbach to Sedan. The attempts that were made to restore the lost connection by consciously leaning upon first the French and then Shakespeare, upon the Volkslied, and finally, in Romanticism, upon the poetry of the age of chivalry, produced at least the unique phenomenon of an art history which, though it never really attained one aim, was constituted for the greater part of flashes of genius. The end of the 18th century witnessed the accomplishment of that remarkable turn with which national consciousness sought to emancipate itself from the dynastic principle. To all appearance, this had happened in England long before. In this connection, Magna Carta, 1215, will occur to most readers, but some will not have failed to observe that, on the contrary, the very recognition of the nation involved in the recognition of its representatives gave the dynastic feeling a fresh enforced depth and refinement to which the peoples of the continent remained almost utter strangers. If the modern Englishman is, without appearing so, the most conservative human being in the world, and if, in consequence, his political management solves its problems so much by wordless harmony of national pulse instead of express discussion, and therefore has been the most successful up to now, the underlying cause is the early emancipation of the dynastic feeling from its expression in monarchical power. The French Revolution, on the contrary, was in this regard only a victory of rationalism. It set free not so much the nation as the concept of the nation. The dynastic has penetrated into the blood of the Western races, and on that very account it is a vexation to their intellect. For a dynasty represents history. It is the history become flesh of a land, and intellect is timeless and unhistorical. The ideas of the revolution were all eternal and true. Universal human rights, freedom and equality are literature and abstraction, and not facts. Call all this republican, if you will. In reality, it was one more case of a minority striving in the name of all to introduce the new ideal into the world of fact. It became a power, but at the cost of the ideal. And all it did was to replace the old felt adherence by the reasoned patriotism of the 19th century, by a civilized nationalism only possible in our culture, which in France itself, and even today, is unconsciously dynastic, and by the concept of the fatherland as dynastic unit, which emerged first in the Spanish and Prussian uprisings against Napoleon, and then in the German and Italian wars of dynastic unification. Out of the opposition of race and speech, blood and intellect, a new and specifically Western ideal arose to confront the genealogical ideal, that of the mother tongue. Enthusiasts there were in both countries who thought to replace the unifying force of the emperor and king idea by the linking of republic and poetry. Something of the return to nature in this, but a return of history to nature. In place of the wars of succession came language struggles, in which one nation sought to force its language, and therewith its nationality, upon the fragments of another. But no one will fail to observe that even the rationalistic conception of a nation as a linguistic unit can at best ignore, never abolish, the dynastic feeling, any more than a Hellenistic Greek could inwardly overcome his polis consciousness, or a modern Jew the national ishma. The mother tongue does not arise out of nothing, but is itself a product of dynastic history. Without the Capetian line, there would have been no French language, but a Romance Frankish in the north and a Provençal in the south. The Italian written language is to be credited to the German emperors, and above all to Frederick II. The modern nations are primarily the populations of an old dynastic history. Yet in the 19th century, the second concept of the nation as a unit of written language has annihilated the Austrian and probably created the American. Thenceforward, there have been in all countries two parties representing the nation in two opposed aspects, as dynastic historical unit and as intellectual unit, the race party and the language party. But these are reflections that evoke too soon problems of politics that must await a later chapter.